Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Maybe you learned this in Econ 101, or maybe you never learned it at all. But the traditional textbook definition of a recession is two consecutive quarters of shrinking GDP. We're still a long way from that, but today the housing market might have pushed us just a tiny bit closer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's Tuesday, October the 30th. It's great to have you with us. It is a little bit excruciating, don't you think, waiting for the moment that somebody's going to say, boom, that's it, we're officially in a recession. There is actually a group that gets to decide when that happens, when the business cycle has turned south. It's called the National Bureau of Economic Research. The way the numbers get crunched, it's probably going to be 6 months or so after any recession would start that we'd hear about it. But as we wait for the Fed's decision on interest rates tomorrow, which might give us some sense of how Mr. Bernanke and his colleagues are feeling about a recession, other economists got some discouraging data today. A leading real estate index said prices for existing homes fell in August at the fastest rate since 1991. Meanwhile, consumer confidence plunged last month. It's now at the lowest level since Hurricane Katrina. From New York, Marketplace's Amy Scott wraps all that up in a tidy package for us.
To Nouriel Roubini, today's housing and consumer confidence numbers are just another sign of an impending recession. Roubini teaches economics at New York University. He predicts the U.S. economy will enter recession by early next year.
First of all, a housing recession is getting worse. We have weakness in capital spending by the corporate sector. There is a credit crunch now. There are high and rising oil prices.
Need he go on? Trouble is, we usually don't find out we're in a recession until after it's started or even finished. The official declarers of such things are members of the Business Cycle Dating Committee at the National Bureau of Economic Research. 88-year-old member Victor Zarnowitz has seen a lot of business cycles in his day. He says the committee hasn't even called a meeting to discuss the matter.
The fact that we haven't called a meeting doesn't mean that we won't.
Zarnowitz says the committee depends on an index of leading indicators, things like business contracts and investments. And so far, that index shows signs of a slowdown, but not an all-out recession. The committee defines recession as a persistent decline in economic activity that shows up in gross domestic product, income and employment, industrial production, and sales. Lakshman Achithan directs the Economic Cycle Research Institute. He says we're not there yet.
I think we're able to get away with that, not having a recession and having slower growth, primarily because we still have pretty low unemployment, which is allowing incomes to be fairly stable or even rise.
Achithan doesn't foresee a recession, at least through the middle of next year, but he says it will eventually happen. That's how business cycles work. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Today seems to be the day on the program for agencies you might never have heard of. The Senate Commerce Committee approved a big budget increase for the Consumer Product Safety Commission this morning. It's been a busy year for the CPSC, what with all the lead-based paint and small magnets that have been showing up in toys. That, in turn, has led to a record number of recalls for a commission that's less than half the size it was back when it was created in the 1970s. But Nancy Knorr, the acting chairman of the CPSC, doesn't want the money that Congress is offering. Our Washington bureau chief, John Dimsdale, has been covering the story for us. Hello, John.
Hello, Kai.
So first things first, what is in this bill that was passed today?
It's pretty comprehensive. It more than doubles the funding over 7 years for the CPSC. It increases staff, increases fines for defective products. It strengthens the government's prosecution powers of company executives. There are whistleblower protections to encourage company employees to contact regulators. It allows states to impose their own stronger rules, and it makes it easier for the government to warn the public about hazards.
All of which sound like something that a person running a Consumer Product Safety Commission would want. Why does Ms. Nord not want any of these things?
Well, she's following the Bush administration's philosophy of minimal regulation. She wants to keep the government out of free markets. This small agency oversees $1.5 trillion worth of products and relies on voluntary actions by the industry. Knowing that it's in the manufacturer's interest to police their own products, the chairman worries that a bigger government hammer on industry will mean less voluntary compliance. She raised her concerns at a Senate hearing earlier this month.
That it is going to decrease the incentives for companies to come to us and work through these problems because the confidentiality isn't protected.
But, you know, her objections to extra clout for her agency totally exasperates the Democrats. Several of them today, including the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, called on her to resign, citing in part her reluctance to ask for more money for the CPSC. And at this month's hearing, Florida's Democratic Senator Bill Nelson said he knows why.
The reason the chairman of the CPSC will not answer the question is that she, as chairman, as a political appointee, is not allowed to ask for more because she is under the orders of the White House Budget Office only to ask for what is approved by the White House budget.
All right, John, make a guess for me. What are the chances that the CPSC is actually going to be reformed and all this money is going to be in that budget?
Well, all the news about tainted products, from toys to toothpaste coming in from China, it's really given this bill a lot of momentum. You know, there was another report out today that there are dangerous levels of lead in some of the Halloween costumes that are coming in from China. It does seem that this small agency has been neglected for some time. The reason Nancy Nord is acting chairman is the Bush administration's nominee for that slot withdrew earlier this year because of strong objections from consumer advocates that his background was not in consumer protection, but instead had been a leading lobbyist for the National Association of Manufacturers. So, you know, for a good part of the year, the commission didn't have a quorum and therefore couldn't take legal action against companies that won't go along with voluntary recalls. So it seems like this reform is needed.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, the voluntary recalls thing, which we learned in the Mattel episodes earlier this summer. Is the president, John, talking about vetoing this bill if it does get passed?
He has raised some objections, but he hasn't used the veto word.
John Dimsdale at the Consumer Product Safety Desk for us in Washington, D.C. Thank you, John.
You're welcome, Kai.
Wall Street put former Merrill Lynch CEO Stan O'Neill in its rearview mirror this morning. The company let him say he was retiring as he stepped down. He goes with the most golden of parachutes. He walks out the door with $161.5 million in his pocket. Elsewhere in Lower Manhattan today, there were some jitters about tomorrow's Fed meeting. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Not counting the Defense Department, there are 16 government agencies that deal in some way, shape, or form with intelligence. They employ about 100,000 people. They manage satellite systems and airplanes. They use the most sophisticated computers and software. They run agents overseas and surveillance equipment back here. But until today, how much all of that cost was a secret. For the first time in almost a decade, the federal government has pulled back the curtain on the American intelligence budget. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports now from Washington that in 2007, the country will spend $43.5 billion to spy on its enemies, plus another $10 billion or so for the Pentagon that is still classified.
The last time the U.S. intelligence budget was made public, back in 1998, America was spending a bit more than $26 billion a year on spying. Since then, the budget has almost doubled. It pays for multi-billion dollar spy satellite programs, remote control spy planes, and salaries for a cast of thousands.
It's about 10 times larger than the intelligence budget of the United Kingdom.
Stephen Aftergood at the Federation of American Scientists has sued the government several times to get these numbers. But until today, even that big $43 billion figure was classified.
By keeping it secret, you impede oversight and you undermine public accountability.
The idea of publicly releasing how much money America spends on spying was initially suggested by the 9/11 Commission and ultimately required by an act of Congress. But this move has been opposed by the Bush administration every step of the way. White House officials argued it would harm national security and, quote, provide significant intelligence to America's adversaries. Tim Romer, a member of the 9/11 Commission and a former member of the House Intelligence Committee, rejects that argument.
This is not a searchlight going into our secret national security programs. This is a match in the cave, just letting the American taxpayer know what we're spending and what we're getting for that tax dollar.
Romer believes the government could go even further and provide individual budget numbers for agencies like the CIA or the National Security Agency. He says that would ultimately make spies more accountable and make all Americans safer. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Differential pricing for utilities is nothing new. You pay less for your electricity when you run your big appliances during off-peak hours than you do if you crank things up right in the middle of the day. But here in Los Angeles today, city officials floated a slight variation on that theme, lower rates for people who use more electricity. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli explains it's a growing trend.
The proposal in Los Angeles mirrors what's happened at utilities in many parts of the U.S. People who live in hotter parts of a city pay a slightly lower rate for the extra electricity that they use.
This is clearly the wave of the future in terms of the way to set electric rates, and it only makes sense.
That's Ralph Cavanna of the Natural Resources Defense Council.
So you want the principle to be the more you use, the more you pay. And you want the principle also to be that people who are in extreme climate zones get a higher baseline allocation of inexpensive power because it takes more power to meet their basic needs.
The way the map has been drawn in Los Angeles, that means people in a wealthier part of the city might actually get a break after they use a certain volume of power, while poorer people in other warmer parts of LA may not. And that's what worries consumer advocate Jamie Court.
The real problem here is this could be a form of energy redlining across the country. We see pockets that will get this type of break because they're politically important to the politicians and to the regulators.
Cavanna of the Natural Resources Defense Council says discrimination isn't the issue. Balancing the load is.
It's not that the rates are different. The point at which the higher rates kick in is different.
Cavanna says something else is different, too. Back in the 60s and 70s, the power companies were offering incentives to promote consumption. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
The gang at the New York Mercantile Exchange took the money and ran today. Oil trades at the NYMEX, where crude tumbled more than $3 down to a what somehow seems rational price of $90.13 a barrel. Goldman Sachs said today, and I quote, it's time to take the profits out of oil. The generally bullish investment bank said it doesn't think there's much upside left as prices close in on $100 a barrel. Even with today's drop, though, black gold has basically doubled in price over the past year, which has left big producers sitting on mountains of cash. But it is possible to tip the balance in the wrong direction. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is spending billions on social programs and international aid. And if the price of oil comes down too far, Venezuela could find itself over a barrel. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch does the math.
Oil experts call it the magic number.
The magic number is the price of crude oil at which Venezuela's national budget will run into a deficit.
That's Jorge Piñon with the University of Miami. Piñon estimates Venezuela's magic number to be $55 a barrel. In other words, if the price of oil goes below 55, Venezuela will not bring in enough money to cover what's going out. Jed Bailey with Cambridge Energy Research Associates is a tad more conservative with his magic number.
A good baseline number somewhere toward the $50 range.
Others, like Michael Schifter with the Inter-American Dialogue, prefer to cover their bases.
I'd say it's about $50, $60 a barrel.
Calculating Venezuela's magic number has become a favorite parlor game for oil analysts. The number is so elusive in part because the country plays with its production numbers. Venezuela says it produces 3.3 million barrels of oil a day. OPEC says the figure is closer to 2.5 million and dropping fast. Schifter says calculating the magic number is part art, part science, and part politics.
what people say depends a lot on what they think about Hugo Chavez and what their political perspective is. So if I take an average of what everybody says, that seems to be a pretty good guess.
PFC Energy publishes the magic number for all the OPEC nations. Qatar is at $21 a barrel because it brings in much more oil money than it spends. Saudi Arabia's break-even point is at $49 a barrel, and Venezuela is at $58, second only to Nigeria's $65. Ed Glav is a business professor at Florida International University. He says Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has good reason to keep his magic number fuzzy.
Clearly, he doesn't want to admit that his policies are in danger of failing. And right now, with prices being so high, I think he's quite capable of covering up the truth.
One thing is clear. Oil money is being funneled into social spending like never before. The state oil firm PDVSA's spending on social development doubled in 2006 to $13.3 billion. The University of Miami's Jorge Piñon.
They're really in a bonanza. They're really in quite a surplus of dollars. They're really behaving like a bunch of drunk sailors on the ship.
With every new petrodollar spent, the magic number ticks upward, and the day when Venezuela starts to run out of cash gets a little closer. Hugo Chavez is wise to this. He started stashing away money, tens of billions in a rainy day reserve, that should keep his economy going, at least for a while. Even after the magic is gone. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Coming up, keeping dreams of Starbucks stardom alive.
I am going to keep on trying. I am not going to stop because I'm good to the last drop.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shaved off 0.5% today, 77 points to close at 13,792. The Nasdaq closed basically flat at 2816. The S&P 500 fell 0.6%, 9 points, ended the day at 1531. Procter & Gamble peeled off 4% after the company's profit forecast fell short of expectations. Shares in Exxon leaked more than 2.5% as oil fell, as I mentioned. Tech stocks continued to hum right along. Both Microsoft and Google each picked up more than 2%. Google is at almost $700 a share. Markets overseas were down. Britain's FTSE tumbled 0.7%. The CAC 40 in Paris gave up more than 0.5%. Back home, bond prices didn't change. The yield on the 10-year T-note stayed right put at 4.38%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, committed to an energy-independent America by increased use of public transportation at publictransportation.org. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here are events for Wednesday, October 31st. French Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner visits China. Verdict sentences will be announced in the trial of 29 people accused in 2004's Madrid train bombings. And on this Halloween day in history, 1926, magician Harry Houdini died in a Detroit hospital. I'm Alex Schmidt.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We know we're hitting the right audience when a farmer writes in about our coverage of the Farm Bill. We covered the $300 billion package a couple of ways. Commentator Jonathan Chait said farmers don't deserve special treatment for, among other things, working long hours outdoors. He said that's true of a lot of jobs, like prostitution. Minnesotan Bruce Johnson was heading back out to his fields for another load of corn when he heard that. Johnson says, first off, farmers do deserve special treatment. Just look at the food on the table if you need reinforcing on that score. And on the other score, well...
As to the comparison of farmers with prostitutes, I only know prostitution from HBO, and I'm sure of many differences, most notably the uniform.
Although we're right on the same coast as Oregon, I clearly need to brush up on that state's electoral process. We had a story last week about a ballot measure that would limit development and curb roadside advertising there. I was too smart by half as I introduced the piece when I said Oregonians would actually go to the polls to cast their ballots. Former Oregonian Jacob Herbold was one of many who wrote to point out my error.
Since the late 1990s, the state of Oregon has done all voting by mail, so I don't think Oregonians will be driving on the highway to vote. They'll be sitting around the kitchen table and hopefully not seeing any billboards from there.
We had the Marketplace Players on last week for a public service announcement about the evils of books on tape and how a marketing push in Atlanta for this kind of in-car entertainment might draw public radio listeners away from the radio. It struck some as funny, others as not. Eric Johansson said our Georgia accent was less than peachy.
As a native in Atlanta and very familiar with the traffic, I found your story drama about books on CD very funny. However, my ears hurt me to hear the horrible attempt at a Georgian accent. We don't speak like Scarlett and Rhett. That was Hollywood.
We're an equal opportunity offender here at Marketplace. While most Red Sox fans have been enjoying the team's win in the World Series, a few of them were also writing in about a commentary we did on the branding of Red Sox Nation. Brendan Hood's a senior at the University of San Diego, and as a former Bostonian, a Red Sox fan too. He wrote to point out that while we said the 2004 Red Sox lived by their Cowboy Up mantra, actually they called themselves the Idiots that year.
Cowboy Up was from the previous season, 2003, and as many Sox fans know, 2003 is a year many want to forget after the devastating loss to the Yankees.
Whatever your team, send us your thoughts about what you hear on the program. Our website is marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. People go to Starbucks for a lot of things, coffee among them, sure, snacks and sweets, and increasingly music. Today, the company said its Hear Music label is going to put out a fresh CD by the 21-year-old singer-songwriter Hillary McCrae. You can get Joni Mitchell and Paul McCartney's albums there, too. Starbucks in-store CD sales are in the millions, so it's not so surprising that unknown artists are knocking on its doors. Well, one artist in particular. Marketplace's Sean Cole explains.
He calls himself DeVito. Just DeVito.
And if you really want to know, it's Big D-A, Big V-I-D-O.
He's a nightclub singer in New Jersey. And about a year and a half ago, he was sitting in Starbucks, chatting up one of the baristas.
And she was drinking a very strong coffee. And she goes, oh my God, this gives me the Java jitters. And I said, ah, oh, that's a great, great idea for a song. And she was really cute.
Sitting at Starbucks, enjoying a latte. When an angel walked by, what a hottie.
Java Jitter was supposed to be DeVito's ticket to stardom. He even got a big-time record promoter to send Starbucks the song. Finally, he'd be on the shelf right next to Paul McCartney, Ray Charles, Vanilla Almond Biscotti.
We really believed that this song would raise the eyebrows of the Starbucks Corporation. We all thought that. We thought the Java Jitter would be a drink. It's a dance.
My baby to the Java Jitter.
But Starbucks rejected Java Jitter, unaware that rejection actually feeds DeVito, makes him stronger. He went down to a local Starbucks with a little film crew. The plan was to make a Java Jitter video in the store and send it to the company.
And literally, they threw us out. I'm telling you, it was almost like an attack. It was so fierce.
Because Starbucks forbids filming. So he went to a different one.
Get out!
He sang at and got kicked out of 203 different Starbuckses.
I'm calling the cops. You see what I'm doing?
The result is a 7-minute video on YouTube called the Starbucks Rejection Tour. And when I first saw the video, I was sure Starbucks was behind it. DeVito and his entourage, dozens of people, do choreographed dances. The girl who plays the barista hottie wears a real Starbucks apron. They even get real baristas involved.
One Java Jitter.
But Starbucks said it had nothing to do with it and really didn't want to talk to me about this.
And they're probably hoping that I'm going to go away, but I'm going to be honest with you, I'm not. This is a guy with a dream. I am the singing Rocky. My baby did the
Java Jitter. That was one of the most dangerous movies ever made, I gotta tell you.
Seth Godin is a marketing guru. He says that winners actually know when to quit, and that DeVito clearly doesn't. But he also says that in an age of digital downloading and infinite shelf space online, Starbucks can afford to give guys like DeVito a chance.
So if I was in Starbucks' shoes, I'd say, this is great, because we got 10,000 people who would love to sell their CDs. Let's let them sell them on the website, and we'll take the 5 best-selling ones and bring them into the store.
But Starbucks doesn't want to deal with it. It says it no longer accepts unsolicited material, which means there are other DeVitos out there treating this coffee company like it's the new Nashville. And who can blame them? Starbucks is publishing and selling CDs to loyal customers lured in by an addictive beverage. I asked DeVito what it would be like to see Java Jitter on the Starbucks CD racks.
Did you ever see a grown man cry?
You think you would cry?
I think I would. I think I would actually cry. I am going to keep on trying. I am not going to stop. Because I'm good to the last drop.
I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
I just want Starbucks to put my sign on the racks! I love my song, Java Jitter!
Marketplace is supported by Consumer Consequences, American Public Media's online game, exploring what the world would be like if everyone on Earth consumed like you. Online at consumerconsequences.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note as we send you on your way, you can say bye-bye to the $50 concert t-shirt. There's a new MySpace widget that takes the merchandise middleman out of the picture. The online merchant Zazzle has set up a deal with MySpace. As of today, bands can set up their own virtual booths on their pages. That means the more than 6 million bands on MySpace, that's an amazing number, will have direct access to the 200 million plus accounts within that social network. Yet another nail in the music label's coffin, perhaps. MySpace and Zazzle, though, are staying mum on the details of their revenue sharing deal. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow dipped 77 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ closed flat. The S&P 500 drooped 9 points. That is 0.6%. All eyes are on the Fed tomorrow. 2:15 East Coast time is the announcement. Thanks today to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, Harley enthusiasts find a new way to ride off into the sunset.
I'll be cremated. I'll be put in the urn. My dogs will be with us. So it'll be my husband and I and the two dogs in the urn and our last motorcycle ride.
All righty then. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.